From PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. Indonesia is hosting a forum bringing together 14 countries to look at the issue of refugees and people smuggling. The forum was the idea of the Indonesian president. It's meant to come up with some concrete policy responses. Australia's Foreign Affairs Minister and Immigration Ministers will be attending the meeting. From Indonesia, here's Helen Brown.
It's a regional problem, but so far no one has come up with a tangible regional solution. Tens of thousands of refugees languish in countries such as Indonesia and Malaysia, waiting years for resettlement. Many others risk their lives on boat trips across the Indian Ocean to try and get to a new country faster. Meanwhile, the main destination point of Australia is doing everything it can to keep them out. But Indonesia's president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, is keen to make a difference.
The solution is... In my opinion, once again, the solution is cooperation that is effective, cooperation that is sincere.
The president has convened a forum involving the countries that would-be refugees are coming from, going through and heading for. It is meant to end in some real policy outcomes and was backed by Australia's Prime Minister Kevin Rudd when the two leaders met in July.
This problem of people smuggling is a problem for our entire region. Therefore, the President's initiative is for all of us to work now together. And I salute you, Mr. President, on your bold initiative.
Australia repeatedly makes requests to Indonesia to help stem the movement of people and boats from its shores. And soon after the July meeting, Indonesia decreed a new rule that would stop people from Iran being able to obtain a visa on arrival. The movement of asylum seekers and refugees is a huge political issue in Australia, and it's a political narrative that Indonesia finds itself dragged into. A joint communique from the leaders' meeting in July spelt out that no country should take unilateral action on the issue, a line that is widely regarded to refer to the plans of Australia's Conservative coalition to turn boats back to Indonesia. But other recent Australian measures could also cause problems. Only a few weeks after the leaders met, Kevin Rudd announced that a deal had been struck with Papua New Guinea for it to take asylum seekers and remove the right for them to settle in Australia. Initially, some of those affected are taking pause and considering staying in Indonesia longer, such as young Afghani man Murtaza.
I paid money to go to Australia by boat, and the government of Australia said that we send the people who arrive by boat, we send them PNG camp, and I gave my money back.
But if there is a build-up of refugee and asylum seeker numbers in Indonesia, Australia's policy may not go down so well. Rwanto Tutusadamo is a senior researcher at the Indonesian Institute of Sciences.
And of course, it's very easy for Indonesia to blame Australia as a source. Why you as a rich country don't want to accept these peoples? I think it's very easy, and I think given the habit of the Indonesian politician, I think they are easily blame Australia as a source. And this certainly will kind of create a kind of tensions between Indonesia and Australia.
The Bali Process is a regional forum already in place to tackle issues such as people smuggling and protection. But after more than 10 years, progress is painfully slow. This meeting is not considered a substitute, but officials hope a smaller gathering of affected nations will produce some focus.
Helen Brown reporting from Indonesia. South Korea and the United States have launched a major military exercise involving tens of thousands of troops. While much of the drill is being played out on computers, it simulates a North Korean invasion. In the past, such events have gathered a furious response from Pyongyang, but not this year, as both sides of the DMZ appear to focus on repairing strained ties. Kandahar Sapati has more.
Relations between the two Koreas is once again entering a new phase. Agreement has been reached to reopen the joint industrial park in Kaesong, and now Pyongyang is prepared to re-establish the family reunion program, which was disbanded in 2010. Professor Jung-hoon Lee from Yonsei University says these developments are not a thaw in relations, just a move necessitated by Pyongyang's economic needs.
What we have is China joining in the international community to really put the squeeze on North Korea. So North Korea is quite desperate for cash coming into North Korea.
The Kaesong Industrial Park and the Mount Kumgang tourism project, which was abandoned in 2008 following the fatal shooting of a South Korean tourist by a North Korean soldier, are the two main sources of income from the South into the North. Pyongyang has responded positively to Seoul's suggestion to the resumption of family reunions, which was suspended in 2010 after two military attacks by the North killed 50 South Koreans. But Pyongyang wants that issue to be linked to the reopening of the tourism program by suggesting that the reunions be held in Mount Kumgang. But with Pyongyang still not offering an apology for the killing of the tourists and for its sinking of the South naval vessel, the Cheonan, Seoul wants the reunions to be held in the truce village of Panmunjom. Professor Lee.
North Korea is very inhumane in trying to use this only as a political tool and has been reluctant to establish an institutionalized mechanism to allow these separated families from getting together as often as they can.
In fact, so keen is Pyongyang to reopen its two sources of income from the South that for the first time it has remained silent about the start of the annual U.S.-South Korea military exercises. Instead of its usual condemnation of these exercises, the North's main newspaper used diplomatic language to advocate solving the peninsula's problems without foreign interference. All part of the North's attempt not to upset Seoul at a time of crucial negotiations, says Professor Lee.
Right now, it seems that they're trying to focus on reopening of the Kumgang Mountain tourism so that this would ensure an additional money coming into North Korea. So until that happens, they're refraining from making any sort of provocative remarks, even on the joint military exercise.
This week will also mark the start of the UN Commission of Inquiry into Crimes Against Humanity conducted by the North Korean regime. A three-man panel led by Australia's Justice Michael Kirby will be holding 5 days of public hearings in Seoul, in which North Korean defectors would be testifying. Meanwhile, Pyongyang is said to be taking a new approach to its defectors. Instead of punishing their families, defectors are being wooed back with promises of cash rewards, homes and jobs. Dr. Jung Hyun Cho from the Korea Institute for National Unification has interviewed many defectors. He says with many returnees defecting again, he believes they are not returning voluntarily.
For the time being, yeah, they can live in Pyongyang and they receive very generous treatment for now. But personally, I'm not so sure about their future. I'm not so optimistic for their future.
With over 25,000 North Korean defectors in the South sending money and news to the North, Dr. Cho says the Kim Jong-un regime feels threatened.
The Kim Jong-un's regime is very young, very fragile, so they seem to need to control over these North Korean defector issues very effectively.
Malaysia has detained and revoked the permanent residency of a Singaporean Muslim resort owner for allowing a group of Buddhists to use a Muslim prayer room for a religious ceremony. Saeed Ahmed Akaf was detained last week and released Friday on bail. Malaysia's Home Minister of Affairs, Ahmed Zawed Hamadi, said the government took the stringent action because of the religious sensitivities in Malaysia. But other community leaders have questioned why the issue has been blown up. Sen Lam speaks to Muhammad Azuri Adini, a former mufti of the Muslim state of Piris, an associate professor at the University of Malaysia.
We should not blow the issue up this extent, because for me, it's just a simple mistake or misunderstanding. Personally, I don't know what is the real reason or the hidden reason of the Prime Minister, but I think this is a very simple mistake that we can correct. It maybe he just does not understand our culture, that's all, but I don't know why we want to blow the issue up so much.
When you say it's a mistake, you're referring to not the government. The government has actually revoked his permanent residency.
Yeah, I don't know, because maybe I cannot give a very deep comment on this, because I don't know what is the hidden reason behind that. No need to go to this extent.
Some people might read Syed Ahmed Al-Kawf's action of allowing the Buddhists to use the surau for their religious ceremony as an example of interfaith cooperation. But speaking as a former mufti of Perlis, you think it's inappropriate for a Muslim room to be used by another faith?
Okay, if the land or the place is owned by a private individual, it's up to the individual if he wants to convert it to a surau or otherwise. Islam does allow for non-Muslim to worship in privately owned prayer rooms or whatever, provided the owner allows you to do that. This surau or this place is owned by individuals, so, and he has his full right to allow who he wants.
So as far as you're concerned, if the premises are used in a respectful manner, Islam is okay with that?
We have to define what is the places of worship we call masjid. Masjid is
it's a proper mosque.
Or the proper mosque, but this is not proper mosque. It's that proper mosque we have to respect. This is very exclusive for Muslim, and like we have church is very exclusive for Christians. But this is not proper mosque. If you look at international airports worldwide, let's say Heathrow, for instance, it has rooms where Muslim and non-Muslim can pray in the same area.
Do you think the government has taken this step because of the rise of Islamic conservatism in Malaysia?
Some people, they are going to that direction. They think that if they make Islam more complicated, more exclusive, they being more Islamic than others. Some people or some groups in Malaysia, they try to convince people that they are more Islamic than others by having or by defending this kind of issue.
Do you think in a country like multiracial country like Malaysia, that this issue perhaps could have been resolved quietly on the ground and not blown up in the media the way it has done? Do you think this might be unhelpful in terms of racial harmony in Malaysia?
It's not good for our country, actually. Being a universal religion where the purest essence of its teaching does not discriminate, I think we should show people that Islam is a universal religion for all, not for some group of people or some races.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Papua New Guinea's foreign minister has rebuffed criticism of the country's asylum seeker deal with Australia. Rimbik Pato says it's the only thing that'll work, dismissing criticism coming from Australia's opposition and others. Speaking at a conference on asylum seekers in Jakarta, Mr. Pato said the deal is already showing results. George Roberts has more.
Rimbik Pato is sounding confident.
The partnership between Australia and Papua New Guinea is one that will stand the test of time.
Last Saturday, the country's Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, was quoted as saying PNG could walk away from the deal to resettle Australia's unwanted refugees. But his Foreign Minister, Mr. Pato, has shot down the Federal Opposition's suggestion that the deal was unravelling.
That is not true. We have a strong partnership with Australia. It's the same deal we did on that issue with the Howard government, then with Julia Gillard, and then now with Kevin Rudd. So unless there's a better solution, which I submit there isn't, this solution is to work.
In fact, he says it's already been so successful, some Iranian asylum seekers are asking to be sent home.
50 of them, on the brief that I got today, have agreed to return back to their country. And this is being processed through the International Migration Organization.
That's being reported in small numbers in Indonesia as well. The country's new head of immigration enforcement is Ida Bugus Adnyana.
The trends that we have here is that there have been an increasing number of foreigners who want to voluntarily go back to their home countries, especially Iranians. There has been an increase in that number. It could be up by 10 people a week.
At the moment, it's boats leaving Australia that have threatened regional diplomatic tension. A group of pro-West Papua independence activists from Australia is attempting to sail into the disputed Indonesian region without permission. The Foreign Minister, Bob Carr, has written to them warning they could face prison and no help from home.
That's right. There'll be no consular support. One, because we're not obliged to. Two, because the laws of the countries they're going to obviously apply. And three, because I'm somewhat tired of seeing Australian taxpayers' money invested on a huge scale in support of people who've been given warnings and know that they're engaged in high-risk behaviour.
The message has registered with the Indonesian government that Australia's on its side.
George Roberts there reporting from Jakarta, Indonesia. The safety of homeless women is a major concern in India's capital, New Delhi, with many subjected to severe abuse and violence. Delhi authorities have done little to address the issue, with little effort to provide either housing or support. The nearly 10,000 homeless women on the streets of Delhi have only 5 shelters to rely on across the city. Murari Krishna has the story.
For over 16 years, Sharda Sharma, a destitute who is now in her mid-30s, has made the unwelcoming streets of Delhi her life. She claims she's lucky to be alive. Turned away by her family when she was young, Sharda says she has struggled to keep her lone daughter alive. Living in bus stations and the pavements of the capital, she has had to suffer and also face disgrace.
I have been kicked, abused, tortured. All possible shame has been heaped on me and nobody has come to my help. All the authorities turn a blind eye. I have an 8-inch scar on my stomach while battling a robber who knifed me trying to steal my possessions.
Thousands of women in Delhi who are homeless and nameless face humiliation on a daily basis. The majority of them are found living in places like roadsides, pavements and drainage pipes. Women constitute nearly 10% of the capital's homeless population, estimated to be at over 120,000. Of the 150 state-run night shelters, 4 are for women and 8 for families, with each shelter accommodating between 50 and 100 homeless people. The rest fend for themselves. Like Sharda, Kusum, another homeless woman who has 4 children, has faced all manner of exploitation from the police and hoodlums. She came to Delhi almost a decade back from the northeastern state of Assam, hoping for a decent livelihood. But her dreams turned sour.
It has been a living hell. Every night I sleep in fear, not knowing who will trample my body, my dignity. I fear for my children even more. I have complained, but nothing has been done. I am scared.
Many battle not only the elements of the weather, but also with repeated sexual and social abuse. Indu Prakash Singh of the Indo Global Social Service Society, a voluntary organization which works for the homeless people, explains.
Many of them would be subjected to rape on the streets. Many of them would be beaten by the police. And in fact, sexual favors are taken by the police. Think of any crime that happens to them. To survive on the streets of Delhi, which tops in criminality in the country, they face the worst. And we have seen ourselves with our own eyes as to how they're treated on the streets. And when we protest, I think they take our complaints but still do nothing about the police who go about beating them and who also have been responsible for killing some women on the streets. Nobody is safe on Delhi streets.
Safety of homeless women is a major concern in the capital. Many women are thrown out on the streets by violent spouses or are girl children who have escaped abuse. Their miserable poverty significantly increases their vulnerabilities. Amita Joseph, a rights activist who's been working with the homeless for several years, maintains the state response has been inadequate.
The state has a duty to protect its most vulnerable citizens. And in the context of Delhi, we are saying that here are women who live on the streets, who are raped day in and day out. It's a daily violence that they face. And therefore, we as a country and as a people owe it to our most vulnerable to protect them and give them safe shelters, housing. In the long run and in the long term, give them social security protection and give them every kind of assistance that a state must provide.
The latest census figures indicate that urban India has over 940,000 homeless people, a significant increase over the 2001 census figures. The increase has caused urban homeless numbers to exceed that of rural homeless populations. However, the problem in the capital is turning from bad to worse.
We now turn our attention to investment in Myanmar. Many countries around the world are pushing companies to invest in the changing economy. In recent years, multinationals and governments have been keen to get a stake in the country as its economy and politicals reform. And now, a British human rights group says many UK companies are holding back and waiting until after the 2015 elections. And it seems that many Australian companies and companies from other countries agree. Bill Bertels has the story.
Myanmar has been opening up its economy over the past 2 years, and the potential economic riches to be gained from investing there haven't been lost on overseas governments. But in the past week, human rights group Burma Campaign UK has said many British companies are staying away from Myanmar. Director Mark Farmaner says they realise the benefits don't outweigh the risks.
A lot of the companies that we have spoken to are sort of in retail and manufacturing, and when they're going and looking at manufacturing in Burma, the problems they identify would include business cronies and military that dominate the economy, and they are concerned that they could be unwittingly going into a business partnership or sourcing from a factory that is owned by someone that is associated with human rights abuses. There's also issues to do with the lack of any sort of labour rights, labour laws.
He says the lure of low-cost manufacturing in Myanmar isn't strong enough yet.
Burma is not significantly cheaper to source from than some other countries. You know, they're asking, you know, why take the risk?
Sean Turnell, an economist with Sydney's Macquarie University and an advisor to the Australia-Myanmar Chamber of Commerce, says some Australian companies are taking a similarly cautious approach.
What you tend to find is that industries that require a large footprint in the country, that make their money out of a prosperous economy and need to use domestic laws and institutions and so on, those are the ones that are hanging back. They're waiting to see what happens in 2015. Some other industries where the returns are much more immediate, things like energy extraction, resources and so on, those sort of companies tend to move earlier.
The Australian government opened a trade office in the commercial centre Yangon in May this year and has appointed a trade commissioner. But Sean Turnell says infrastructure issues, aside from political uncertainty, are also hampering investment.
In Burma, it's very, very difficult, for instance, to get reliable electricity. Likewise, the roads are not very good, internet connections bad.
Aside from Australia and the UK, what about the broader picture? What do you know about other countries and their investment strategy?
If one was to look at Asia, Japan, China, Thailand and so on, we see a different pattern. We see a much broader push, if you like, going into the country. So there's quite a dichotomy too, depending on which region of the world that we're talking about.
Throughout the Pacific, internet speed is a problem. Well, that changed this week for Tonga. With much fanfare, the high-speed cable was launched by King Tupu. The fiber optic cable will connect Tonga's internet traffic to Fiji and onward to a hub in Sydney. Tonga Cable's managing director, Robert Bourli, says the cable will improve business, health and education opportunities. He speaks next to Geraldine Coutts.
Well, it certainly benefits everybody in Tonga with a faster, more efficient and lower price internet. At this stage, because our connection is through satellite, it takes a lot of time when you want to get into internet to retrieve information or download anything. And also the bandwidth available in the satellite is quite limited. But now with the cable, the bandwidth practically is unlimited compared to demands from the country. Much faster speed and more efficient and reliable.
Now, when it goes live, is it going to go with great fanfare? Have you got many people who have signed on to go live?
That part is actually the responsibility of service providers. We provide wholesale bandwidth to telecommunication service providers in Tonga, and it's their responsibility to retail it and reach to end users. I understand that one of them, TCC, that has signed on the cable, release the capacity immediately. They have announced new packages that would be available to their customers effective 1st of September, but the current customer of TCC, customers of TCC should see quite a bit faster speed and benefit from that.
Okay, so let me just understand, it will go live this week, but customers won't be able to start using it until September.
No, they will. They will, under the current package, they will be able to use the system, and they are going to get much faster speed at this stage. However, because the price of wholesale has dropped tremendously, that would be reflected from 1st of September.
Now, how have you been able to get this faster cable service into Tonga?
The cable system that we have is part of regional connectivity by World Bank. This is the first phase of that, and we are connecting from here to Fiji and from Fiji to Southern Cross, and it becomes part of the international network because Southern Cross carries our traffic to Australia in Equinix data center, and from there goes to the gateway.
Further down the track, what will this enable businesses to do now that they've got this faster cable service?
There will be tremendous benefits to the businesses. Right now, for example, in Tonga, if you try to place an order and go online for supply of equipment for your company, sometimes you have to give up because of the time that you have to wait. Sometimes the internet will tell you it's timed out and it cuts you off. It will provide much better access and faster. The businesses can possibly market their products online, especially when it comes to tourism. They would be able to attract more customers probably. And of course, it has a lot of other benefits in regards to education, health and other areas.
Tonga, of course, has its fair share of bad weather and cyclones. Will this be able to withstand all of that? And in fact, will it be able to be used as part of the cyclone warning system?
Absolutely. The cable is under the sea, so it's quite secure. It should not be affected by cyclone or any other weather condition. The building itself where the cable lands is quite solid, is designed for this purpose, and it should be able to continue operation even during the cyclone and after that.
Now, when it does go live, will it go with some fanfare? Will there be celebrations?
Major celebration, yes. We have celebration, official launching that is going to take place, and His Majesty King Tukul VI is going to be present. And he will be officially launching the system. It is a major event for the country. We are very happy that this is finally happening. We have been working on this project for a long time with the support and assistance from government and private sector. All together have been working on this one, and great to see that it's finally coming to fulfillment.
And with that story on Tonga getting high-speed internet, we come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Or you can check us out online at www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. So until next time, friends, this is Keith Palomo saying so long, take care. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Bye-bye.